There's no reservoir of potential that's bottled up somewhere that you can't quite access, or you're not allowed to or being asked to access, but you're bringing all of yourself to whatever the endeavor is, and you feel really good about that. And you have this sense that you're bringing your best self to it and performing at your best.
In this interview, I'm joined by Jonathan Fields. Jonathan is an award-winning author, entrepreneur, Webby-nominated producer, and host of one of the world's top podcasts, The Good Life Project. He's been featured in outlets including The New York Times, CNN, The Guardian, and Fast Company. His most recent book is Sparked, and this provides a simple framework for helping individuals to discover the work that makes them come most fully alive, and this is the focus of today's conversation. You'll learn Jonathan's philosophy of maximum sustainable generosity and how this helps him to avoid burnout, the 10 sparketypes, and how Jonathan's assessment can provide deep insights into the work that you find most meaningful and energizing, the relationship between your primary sparketype, shadow sparketype, and anti-sparketype, why thinking small and experimental mindset are vital if you want to make a meaningful impact in the world, and more. You can learn more about Jonathan's innovative work at jonathanfields.com and take an assessment at sparketype.com. Okay, Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me here.
To get started, so you run an amazing project called The Good Life Project, and something I wanted to ask you was, what is your definition of the good life?
Yeah, you know, what I've learned over the years, and we've been running that project for about a dozen years now, and through that, I've had the opportunity to sit down and ask that very question to everyone from my next door neighbor to some of the most famous people in the world to some of the most accomplished and well-known scientists and researchers out there. And while everyone answers a little bit differently, there are certainly recurring patterns or themes. And what I've really seen it come down to is the intersection between three things, what I would call vitality, or the state of your mind and body, the state of your connections, you know, the depth and quality of your relationship with yourself, with any intimate people around you, with family or chosen family, friends, with local community, and if it's part of your belief system or experience, anything that's bigger than that. And then the third element is what I would call contribution. And that is, most people interpret it as the work we do in the world, but it's really, it's the thing that most of us exert a substantial amount of effort towards over a sustained period of time. That may be your job, that may be your primary devotion if you're, for example, a caretaker or a parent. But it's the intersection between those three things: vitality, connection, and contribution. And I look at them as three buckets. And in my mind, the fuller we can make those buckets at any given time, the better life feels to us. And the emptier those buckets get, the more life starts to grind down and feel like it's not the way that we want to feel. And all three of those buckets also feed into each other. So it's actually impossible to leave one behind and say, I'll get back to it. You know, if we ignore our vitality bucket for months or years because we're going hard into the contribution one, eventually that vitality bucket is going to make it really hard to actually keep filling our contribution bucket. It's going to literally take us to our knees, so we can't do the work that we want to do on the level we want to do it. Same thing with connection. So to me, I use that simple model, you know, the three buckets: connection, contribution, and vitality. And it's a process of doing a little something pretty much every day to just check in, see how full or empty they are, and nourish the ones that are in need of a bit of love. And I feel like if you do that on a day-to-day basis, then the bigger picture, the longer term, kind of figures itself out.
I like that. It's very holistic and takes all of the most important things in life into consideration. Can you tell me about maximum sustainable generosity and your thinking about this?
Yeah, so that concept kind of emerged over time. And it's the idea that very often a big part of a good life is a certain sense of generosity, of giving yourself away. You know, David Brooks has a really interesting frame in his book, The Second Mountain. where, you know, he says so often we spend the first part of our lives traveling up this mountain, which is largely ego driven. And then something happens that drops us down into the valley and then into the wilderness. And then if we're fortunate, we start up a second mountain, which is instead of about acquisition, it's more about giving ourselves away. And for sure, you know, and you know this through so many of the people you've spoken to, so much of the work that you do, that there's a lot of rich science and philosophy that tells us that the process of giving ourselves away, of being generous in some way, is not just helpful for others, but it's deeply nourishing for us just as individuals. So, you know, the idea is how can we give ourselves away? Like, how can we be as generous as we can possibly be? But at the same time, and Adam Grant hints at this, it was in his first book, actually, where he really looked at the science between giving and taking. You know, there's a certain threshold after which when you give, you start to risk the potential of depleting your own personal resources to just be able to sustain yourself as a human being and keep filling that well so that you have something to give. So the idea of maximum sustainable generosity for me is like, how can I figure out a way to be as generous as I can, but at the same time also acknowledge the very human side of it, which is that I also, you know, I need to fill my own well. You know, as an example, I'm much more on the introverted side of the spectrum. My social orientation loves deep, intimate conversations with people. And at the same time, if I find myself in large social settings, it's much more energetically depleting for me. That said, part of my work in the world is to place myself in settings like that. You know, I speak from stages, I go to gatherings and events where, you know, those experiences happen. And I love to be as present and as generous as I possibly can in those moments. But I also know that I will hit a certain point. And if I don't retreat, if I don't go and take a walk outside and, you know, like go into nature or in the woods or just meditate or just be quiet, be in solitude for a certain amount of time, that my well, my ability to be present and generous will be empty. And then I'm of no use to anybody, including myself. So I've learned that about myself. So the sustainable part of that maximum sustainable generosity is that, you know, is the idea of knowing yourself well enough to know when your own tank is becoming so depleted that you're losing the capacity to be present and generous, and then doing the things that will take care of you and refill your own tank along the way.
Very interesting. I'm aware that you're a highly sensitive person, according to the Aline Arons trait, you know, the one she came up with. How do you thrive as a highly sensitive person? And have you got any advice for anybody else that would also identify as a HSP?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny. I think I didn't actually realize that I was an HSP until I interviewed Elaine and we were walking through the ideas. And my mind is starting to, you know, like as she's sort of describing different elements as I'm doing research around it, my mind is going check, 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 check. I'm like, oh yeah, like that. That in fact probably is me. And I think a lot of it again comes back to self-awareness. You know, once you realize that you are sensitive to environments, to processing, to stimuli, then the question becomes, how can I do what I feel like I'm here to do? How can I do good work? How can I be present in my relationships and also nourish myself? And for me, a lot of that is about solitude and nature. So I'm very fortunate after 30 years living in New York City, where, you know, you are constantly surrounded by stimulus and sound and energy and excitement. 3 years ago, we moved out to Boulder, Colorado. So I'm living in a mountain town, and 7 minutes out my front door are some of the most beautiful hiking trails literally on the planet. And I'll find myself very often actually in the middle of the day, just taking an hour, sometimes an hour and a half, knocking off, throwing on my hiking boots. It's snowy here today. The trails will be icy and snowy and slick and wet. And later today, I will be out there with my hiking boots and my spikes, smiling my face off, because I know that helps me to reset, to sort of like touch stone, and then drop back down into, interactions and conversations and be more forward facing and present when I need to, and still be able to feel okay along the way.
Very cool. Okay, so you've had a very varied working life. I think you started as a lawyer and then you started Sonic Yoga. You've got the podcast, you've written best-selling books. What would you say is the common thread that unites all of these different projects? And what would you say the central question that's been driving your working life has been?
Yeah, so the common thread is that, and actually, if you look at my personal website, the top panel on the website has one single sentence, which is, I make things that move people. That has taken many different forms over many different years. You know, in the early days, it was experiences, or it was, you know, like personal interactions. It became companies, it became brands. You know, even before what you described, even in college, you know, while I was taking classes, I also started a company. I have been making companies for as long as I can remember. And that company was a mobile lighting and disc jockey business, where we created experiences for people that, you know, I have language for it now that I didn't have back then. And I would describe it as experiences of Emile Durkheim's collective effervescence, you know, where we would have 500 people on a dance floor for 4 hours, transcending the moment, transcending the container. And what I learned very early on is that the intersection between my ability to create something from nothing and then to see that that something goes out into the world and has an effect on people that is positive, that is change-making in some way, even if it's momentary, has been a part of my DNA from the earliest days. And it's shown up in businesses, brands, books, experiences, pretty much anything that we've done for so long. So that's really the common thread. And the question that probably runs along with that is, like, really just how can I continue to make things that move people? And I'm more agnostic in terms of the form that that takes. I happen to have a passion for writing. So I do love the craft of writing, but I also love the craft of creating a container that brings people together. And I love the art and craft and science and Hail Mary pass of starting a company, which I've done many times over at this point. So, but those are sort of the central through lines when you kind of dig beneath the surface of all the different things.
I think it's such a worthwhile exercise to maybe go back through all of your past experiences, whether in your personal life or your working life or whatever, and ask, what is the thread here? And is there a question that sort of unites them all? You know, when I did it, there's one that came to mind for me that is basically, like, I like sharing ideas that help people improve their lives. You know, that seems to be the common thread in everything I've done in my working life, you know? So something else I wanted to ask you about was, how has Milton Glaser impacted your thinking? I think you interviewed him like about a decade ago. Like, yeah. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, one of the most powerful conversations I think I've ever had. So for those who don't know who Milton Glaser is, many people don't know the name unless you were in the world of design or you were one of his many students after 40 years of teaching. But pretty much everybody knows his work. They just don't know that it was his work. So the most obvious example of that is the single most ripped off logo or brand identity in history, iHeartNY, was actually created by Milton, who was born and raised and lived his entire life in New York City. He was a diehard New Yorker. And in the 70s, when the city was in a lot of trouble financially, he basically said, I need to take my genius. And his genius was really creating design, art and design and storytelling and messaging that was powerful. And he said, I need to do something that sort of like reminds people how amazing this place is and bring them back. In the back of a cab on a napkin, he just basically came up with that logo. And then, you know, my understanding is also was never paid for it. He offered it. That was that generosity side to basically the city to rebrand the experience of New York City. So that has now become, you know, like, how many variations have we seen of that all over the world over decades now? But Milton spent his entire life knowing who he was and who he wasn't. He also started New York Magazine, but he had a design studio in New York. He could have easily been the founder of a massive, you know, like, commercial agency, but he kept it very small and intimate. He had a townhouse in New York City. He had a small team and he worked with them. He was also somebody who fiercely resisted being contained. You know, like people would come to him and say, like, I want, you know, like the Milton Glaser style on this particular thing. And he would basically say, no, like whatever I've done in the past, whatever brought you to me, that's the past. And whatever I decide to pour into this project, if we work together, I need to be free to actually create something fresh, something new. So when you look at his work over a period of literally 9 decades, you see just this profound evolution and profound, profound devotion to being who he wanted to be and needed to be. At the same time, he produced a stunning, stunning volume of work, from commercial work to museum shows to the artistry and the commercial side, where it affected so many people. He also taught. So he's a professor for many decades. So he taught generations and generations of the people who've now gone out in the world and created the brands and the stories and the designs that so many of us are affected by. So his impact has just been stunning. Milton, when I had the opportunity to sit down with him, was, I believe, in his mid-80s, and still very much at his studio, alive, vibrant, deeply, deeply electrified by the work that he was doing. He was working on a new museum show when I saw him, and we spent time just really deepening into it. And he kept doing that, you know, until the very end. He died, I believe, at 91, just a couple of years ago, on his birthday, by the way. you know, the example that he set for me in so many ways, by the way that he was, by the work that he did, by the impact that he made, by the fierce devotion to being him and showing up in the way that, you know, honored his own inner truth, has always stayed with me. And his devotion to then giving back, you know, and teaching and sharing and nurturing and mentoring for generations, to really teach these same ideas to people has been profound. Like that, like you said, that conversation we recorded, I think, over a decade ago now, and I think about it so often.
What a life. Now, if anybody's listening to this and they're kind of curious to maybe learn more about him, in addition to listening to Milton's interview with you, are there any books that you'd recommend, like any biographies of him that you're aware of? Or because it sounds like it's worth, you know, really learning more about this guy.
Yeah, I don't actually know if there are biographies. I have a number of books that he's written. I'm blanking on the name of the ones that I have literally downstairs in my bookshelf right now. But he was fairly generous in doing interviews. So he's done a series of interviews. I think, you know, to really get familiar with it, certainly you're welcome to listen to the conversation we had. But if you literally just, you know, like go to YouTube and Google his name, you'll find some fantastic interviews, and literally so much of what pours out of his mouth, you'll want to have a pen and paper or like whatever your favorite note app is there to just write it down, because it's provocative, it's real, and it's kind, and it'll make you think.
Awesome. Awesome. Can you tell me about your experimental mindset and how you approach big projects? Because you've done some pretty big things in your working life. How do you think about approaching these things?
Yeah. So the name of the entity you described earlier in our conversation, Good Life Project, we launched that in January of 2012. You know, we're having this conversation in 2024, so about a dozen years in that endeavor. The word project is built into that because from the day that I started, I looked at it as an experiment. And this is the way that I look at almost everything in my life. So rather than saying, you know, like this is a thing that has to succeed, this is a thing that like I have to make happen, or and I have to commit to for X period of time, I look at almost everything as a project or as an experiment and say, you know what? I don't know how this is going to make me feel. I don't know if it's going to succeed or fail. I don't know if it's going to make a difference in other people's lives. But there's a little thing inside of me that says, I'm interested, I'm curious, and maybe it will. So let me treat this rather than saying, this is a thing I'm going to commit myself to and it must succeed. Let me just run the experiment and see, like, what are the first few steps, and step into it and see, well, how does it make me feel? Does it seem like it would work? Are there changes that I need to make? that would make it more, quote, successful? Like, could I turn it into a business? Should I turn it into a business? Or should this be just a passion that that fuels me? And, you know, I find that by taking more of a project or experimental approach to almost every element of life, it avoids the trap of feeling like I've said yes to something and then failed at it, rather than just saying, you know, like, well, I'm going to basically say yes to the first couple of steps. And my primary metric for whatever it is not necessarily, quote, success or failure from the way that most outside people would look at it, but it's learning. Have I learned? Like, have I learned something? So if I learned something in the first couple of steps, that's awesome. If I decide after that, that it's not for me, or I don't think it could actually be what I thought it could be, or it's not making the difference I thought it would make, then I'm really good just walking away from it. You know, it's one of the reasons why I've had a number of businesses and I've had the good fortune to be able to exit them. And, you know, the last day when I handed over the keys, I felt complete. I didn't feel like I was, walking away from something or that I hadn't succeeded at it. You know, somebody buys the company and I hand over the keys and I walk out the door and I'm good, because the entire time for me, it's a project, it's an experiment. And as long as it keeps fueling me and doing what I hoped it would do and I'm learning, I'm great. But if I hit a point where I'm not learning anymore, or I feel like it would be better off in someone else's hands, or there's just a voice inside of me that says it's time to move on to your next thing, then I allow space for that. And I feel like it's a much more interesting and forgiving way to live. And it also lets you really let go of shame and judgment along the way, because as long as you're learning, then there's something in it that's worthwhile.
That's a very freeing perspective that I think could, if you were to really embody it and take on board, it could really free up a lot of people's creative potential, you know? So that's awesome. Can you tell me about your book Sparked? And let's start by just defining what actually is a sparkotype, and how did you come up with this concept?
Yeah, so I'll give you a little bit of the background, because I think it'll really help with the context. So I have been deeply fascinated with what most people would call work for over two decades now. You know, like that thing that we wake up in the morning, we walk out the door. These days, very often, we don't walk out the door. We stay in our own home, or we go to the office or the studio, and then we do for the vast majority of the day, and then we wrap up our day. You know, it's the thing that most people do for the vast majority of their waking hours for the entirety of their adult lives. And I've been deeply fascinated at the question of how do we make that thing not just contribute to the world in a meaningful way, but make us feel the way that we want to feel. And to me, like, the big question is, how do we want it to make us feel? So I, over time, really deconstructed that down to five different component states. One is meaning. Like, I want to feel like the thing that I'm doing is deeply meaningful. Two is energy and excitement. You know, I want to feel energized. I want to feel like even if it's hard and the hours are long, and as a lifelong entrepreneur, it is often hard and the hours are often long, that I still am excited to wake up on a Monday and do it. And then I'm energized by it when I'm doing it. And even after a 15-hour day, I wake up the next day and I'm like, you know what? I'm still all in on this. I want to do it. The third component is flow. And I know you've had conversations over the years, you know, about flow and flow states. And, you know, based largely on, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi just, first coined the phrase really in relationship to this state, but the ability to lose time, to absorb yourself in an activity, to like go into that otherworldly state where you become part of the thing and you feel like you're literally here doing the thing that you were meant to do. The fourth component is what I would call expressed potential. Like, you're bringing all of yourself. There's no reservoir of potential that's bottled up somewhere that you can't quite access, or you're not allowed to, or being asked to access, but you're bringing all of yourself to whatever the endeavor is. And you feel really good about that. And you have this sense that you're bringing your best self to it and performing at your best. And the fifth piece of it is purpose, which is different than meaning. You know, purpose is really on its purest level, it's this notion that there is something that you're working towards. You know what it is, it's well-defined, and it matters to you. So to me, the feeling of being sparked by your work is the intersection between those five different component states. And I've really started to wonder over the years, like, how do we actually get that feeling as often as we can? A lot of this was actually touched off around 9/11 for me. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, I spent my entire adult life, except for the last 3 years, in New York City. So I was there during 9/11, 2001, and knew people who went to work that day and never came home. And one of those people was actually one of the youngest partners in a firm that was at the top of one of the towers with, you know, like two young children, just built their dream house, married, never came home. Didn't expect to go to work that day and not come home, but that was this person's fate. And it really hit me. And just the state of the city in the 6 months that followed sent me into a place where I really wanted to deepen into this question. And so I've been in this question for over two decades now. And in 2018, I started to get really curious and say, well, I wonder if there is an identifiable set of impulses for effort or for work that exist across all people that would be mappable. And because if there was, and we could figure those out, and people could learn what those impulses were, then it would really help with this quest of trying to figure out, where do I devote my attention? What do I say yes or no to? So this launched a research project in 2018, really deconstructing thousands of different jobs, titles, industries, to look for patterns and overlap and components. And it distilled astonishingly quickly down to these 10 different impulses. To this day, I actually really don't like the fact that we've identified 10, because it feels way too slick for me. You know, I kind of wish it was 13 or 9 or something like that. It feels, but we did, in fact, identify these things. And once we identified them, I started to also realize that each one of these impulses for work, that gives us this feeling, also tends to have an identifiable set of behaviors, tendencies, and patterns that wrap around them to form archetypes. So we started calling them sparkotypes, because it was just a fun shorthand for the archetype for work that sparks you. And it stuck. I started sharing them around. And I'm very fortunate also in the work that I do to have ready access to just brilliant and wise and kind colleagues and friends who are in the social sciences space and positive psychology to help me really refine these ideas and bounce them off and see what's real and what's not real. And as we started sharing these around and getting incredible feedback, I said, you know, there's something here that goes beyond my own personal curiosity. So we spent the entire year of 2018 developing an assessment to try and do two things. One, see if we can validate these on a larger scale with more data. And two, also create potentially a tool that was public facing that anyone could actually spend 10 or 15 minutes, you know, like taking and learn what their particular sparkotype was. And we basically built the tool in the beginning to identify two things, what we call your primary and shadow sparkotype. And this is not shadow in terms of the Jungian version of shadow. This is kind of like, think of it as your first place and second place, you know, like your strongest impulse and your runner-up impulse. 2 years later, we realized that there was something else that we were collecting data on that we weren't reporting. And we had to rebuild the algorithm to get really accurate with it. And that's what we call your anti-sparkotype. This is the type of work that is the heaviest lift. It takes the most energy out of you and requires the greatest amount of recovery. So now when somebody takes the assessment, they learn these what we call your sparkotype profile, with these three component states: your primary, your strongest impulse for work that makes you come alive, your shadow, that would be your runner-up or second one, and your anti-sparkotype, the work that's the heaviest lift. So we released the initial version at the end of 2018. We released the revised algorithm version in 2021. As we have this conversation, about 850,000 people have completed the assessment. So we're sitting on a data set of around 43 million data points, making this one of the largest ever surveys of work-life fulfillment that's ever been done on a global scale. And the insights are really powerful. And we've done a follow-up survey also, because once we realized that the feedback that we're getting anecdotally, and now we have, like, we're talking big data at this point. So we have a ton of anecdotal feedback that started pouring in, and people were saying, I've never actually taken something like this. The results that I'm getting are different than anything I've ever done. I've done every other assessment, every personality test out there, and this is different. And I feel the word we kept hearing over and over and over is, it feels very accurate, and I feel validated. Now, of course, no other person can validate another being. Any assessment that's really doing its job, it's just a mirror. You know, like we're processing what people are putting into it in a way that reflects back to somebody the essence of who they are and what they've told us, but with more clarity and language that allows them to see themselves in a way that maybe wasn't on the surface before. And we did a follow-on survey that then showed us really strong statistical correlation for those five component states that I described before: meaningfulness, flow, energy and excitement, expressed potential, and purpose. So now we have data that actually shows, if we have any data-oriented people who are listening, correlation coefficients or R values between 0.5 and 0.8. So really strong correlations between doing the work of your sparkotype and experiencing those five component states. And we also have the inverse data, which shows that the less you do the work of your sparkotype during your day, the less likely that you are to feel those five component states. So this is built over the years into something that I started as a personal curiosity, as a quote experiment, as you described earlier. And very quickly, when we saw how rapidly people were participating in this and then sharing it, and it became this massive kind of a phenomenon that we never saw coming, we really, really took the time and we split it actually into its own business and research endeavor, and then started to build a lot of process around it. Because then people would start to ask us, well, what do we do with this information? It feels powerful. Automatically, I'm getting ideas and it's telling me things that I didn't know before, but how do I use this in my day-to-day life? How do I use this to help guide my decisions about what to say yes or no to, especially when it comes to the work that I'm doing? So over the last 3 or 4 years, we've gone deep into building just a mountain of process and programming around it. We are, as literally as we have this conversation this year, we'll start to release more of that publicly. We've kept a lot of that process too. We started training and certifying coaches and consultants and advisors, and even at times therapists and physicians in the methodology. And they would help us really refine this and bring real world examples and data back to us. And so we've developed this process and shared it almost entirely just with trained professionals. And this year, we're actually about to, for the first time, make it much more publicly available, in no small part because the state of humanity is sort of, and people who are taking the assessment are really demanding that we want a lot more just assistance along the way, like help us understand what to do with these insights. So that was a very long-winded backstory, but I hope it gives you the context that you're looking for.
I heard you say in another interview that one of your motivations for doing this is that you wanted to help people feel seen. And that was the sensation I had after I completed the assessment, and I kind of understood my sort of primary and shadow and the ante as well. So that's really, really interesting. Now, I want to give people a better idea here. So I'm going to name the different sparkotypes, and then I want you to sort of just give like a brief explanation of what that is and maybe some of the characteristics?
Yeah, happy to.
Okay, let's start with Sage.
So the Sage's primary impulse is to illuminate, to share insight, to awaken insight. So this is somebody where you know something, but it's not enough to know it yourself. The immediate thing as soon as you learn something is to turn around and share it with other people. And you don't just want credit for sharing it. You really want them to understand it. So that's the primary impulse for the Sage.
Cool. Maven.
Maven is all about knowledge acquisition. You know, the Maven wakes up in the morning and all they want to do is they want to lay their head on the pillow at night before they go to bed, knowing that they've learned something new. So Mavens, it's all about the process of learning. They live to learn. And that can be in a very narrow, focused, and deep way, or it can just be a broad-based curiosity with anything and everything. And sometimes it bounces between those two phases.
Cool. Maker, I think that's your primary, am I right?
It is, yeah. That is my primary. And that is all about making ideas manifest. So it's about the process of creation. It's a fiercely generative impulse. And makers also tend towards different parts of the creation process. Some are the sort of 0-to-1 maker, where like you love to go from idea to basic thing and then hand it off to somebody else when it comes to complexity and scale and process. And then some actually like that second phase where it's like, let me take this and then build it into something much more substantial. I happen to be the 0-1 person, by the way.
Me too. We're just building a new course there recently, and I love the initial stage, like getting everything off the ground. And then I just, once that's done, I just want to give it to somebody else and just don't want anything to do with it, you know, but you have to stick it in there. It's a problem. Scientist.
Yeah. So the impulse for the scientist is to figure things out. Like, this is the classic Richard Feynman, you know, when he was given the Nobel Prize for physics, and his response to that was basically like disdain for the prize. He said, the reason I do this is it's the kick in figuring the thing out. And that's the classic scientist impulse, you know, so burning questions, big puzzles, complexity is the thing that drives the scientist, whether what they figure out has, you know, like utility for other people. And sometimes it does, you know, if you're cancer research and you figure out some incredible new treatment, it could affect millions of people's lives. It's a really nice part of it, but it's actually not why the scientist does what they do on the purest level. It's literally the process of being immersed in a question and pursuing the answer.
Essentialist.
Essentialist is all about creating order from chaos. This is about systems, clarity, process, and utility. Very often essentialists experience this process in an interesting way as artistry, as the pursuit of elegance and beauty. So they could look at a wildly complex spreadsheet or process diagram that they've created, and to them, this is high art. Whereas another person who's a non-essentialist looks at this, and all they want to do is cry and like pretend that like they never have to be involved in the creation or the use of this at all. The essentialist is actually my anti-sparkotype. I love the fact that we have people in our organization that do this work. I benefit incredibly from the process and systems and clarity and utility that they create. And I also love the fact that I'm not the one who has to do it.
For sure. Well, I think, you know, I've heard you get this reframe. Like someone said to you, like, I got my primary as an essentialist, and they were really disappointed. And you were like, look, like there are so few people in the world that have that as their primary. So you are like, you're like gold dust, you know, because you're never going to be out of demand. Like everyone needs the essentialist. So I think it's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. So true.
The performer, that's actually my anti-sparkotype.
Yeah. And it's actually the most common anti-sparkotype in our data set. The performer's impulse is to animate or energize an interaction moment or experience. And a lot of people, when they hear that, they're like, well, that must be performing art. You're an actor, singer, dancer. And often when this impulse expresses itself when you're younger, people are channeled into that because it's the, quote, socially appropriate way to channel that kind of energy or impulse. But then you get boxed into it. And then very often people who are channeled into that as kids, when their parents see them wanting to pursue that more seriously, the parents freak out because they're like, you'll never be able to support yourself doing that. And they de-emphasize, or they even basically tell the kid that that is not an appropriate or a real impulse, and it becomes stifled until something happens later in life. The important thing to note about the performer is that this impulse is powerful and useful in nearly every domain, every activity. You know, if you are in business development, you can bring it to that. If you're a bartender, you can bring it to that. If you're having a parent like trying to like animate a conversation with a kid, if you're a teacher trying to really bring beautiful energy and interactivity and excitement to a classroom, you can bring it there. So it's a much more transferable impulse than people sometimes initially think.
Very cool. You know, that strikes me that because these things are so at our core, they're like, you know, they're so basic to us that no matter what we're doing, we can find ways to express them in day-to-day life. It doesn't have to be our whole career. Like you just find ways to express them, and that's going to energize you just because that's who you are.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you're fortunate enough to be able to actually do the work to figure out how to center these in your career, that's amazing. Like what a gift that is. And at the same time, some people face certain realities where there are certain limitations or restrictions where it's harder maybe for them to do that, or, you know, maybe in the season that they're in life. But the beautiful thing is, like you just said, that doesn't mean that you can't bring it to all these other pursuits, you know, that surround that central work experience.
Yeah. Warrior.
Warrior is all about bringing people together and leading them. That doesn't mean that people who are not this type will not be effective leaders. You know, like a lot of people are leaders, and there's a whole set of skills that accompany the experience of leadership. But the warrior has something that's intrinsic to them that just wakes up in the morning and wants to gather people and take them from where they are to a different place where everybody would love to be. This tends to show up very early in life as the kid in school or the kid in the playground who's bringing the other kids together and say, like, let's start this new game, or let's create an adventure, or, you know, like be captain of a particular team, like on chess or sports or music, whatever it may be. It's the person who loves to be in that space. And as I said, anyone can gain and learn the skills of leadership, and many people will and be highly effective at it. The warrior has an impulse to want to do that in a way that's deeply intrinsic.
Hmm. And what about the advisor?
Yeah, the advisor is all about guiding others through a process of growth. So the advisor tends to walk beside another individual, a group, a team, could be an entire company, as they're moving through a process of growth, sort of being a trusted confidant. It's a deeply relational impulse. You know, the warrior is largely about creating trust and safety and intimacy so that they can do their work. And very often, unlike the warrior, very often is sort of like within the group that they're leading. So they lead from within. The advisor invariably tends to be outside of that, which is a good thing because that often brings more objectivity along the way.
And the advocate?
The advocate's impulse is basically to shine the light on ideas, ideals, communities, individuals, sometimes causes, where they feel like it's not getting the attention that they need. The advocate often, again, shows itself very early in life. It's driven by often a very strong sense of justice, you know, and that justice can be large social causes. That justice can be, you know, when you're 6 years old and you're in a classroom and you see, you know, like the teacher treating three different kids in three different ways, and you feel just this compulsion to speak up about it because you just know it's not okay. It can be when you're, you know, an adult in a meeting and you know that there's a quieter person down at the end of the table who you talked to before who has a great idea that would be, you know, amazing if they contributed to this topic, but the culture of the meeting really isn't letting them do that. And you're the person who says, listen, you know, like we need to actually hear, like there's this amazing idea that we need to hear from. So you're championing. It's a championing type of energy around ideas, ideals, individuals, and experiences.
There's such a need for people like that in the world, I think, you know, just to give voice to the people that don't normally get the chance to express themselves. And the last one, nurturer.
Yeah. The core impulse of the nurturer is to elevate others. It's to give care. It's to take care. It's a very nourishing and a deeply outflowing orientation. And often when others won't actually or can't give that need, it doesn't necessarily have to be to other individuals, by the way. It can be to communities. It can be to animals. It can be to environments. You know, like you could have a nurturer impulse and a direct application of that to nature, to the environment. Like you may actually feel like I need to actually give love to, there's a plot in my neighborhood that is completely abandoned. And, you know, I want to make that a garden. I just want to love up all these plants and I want to love up all the people in my neighborhood around it who will benefit from this. So it can express itself in a lot of different ways. It is, you know, you talked about earlier in our conversation, that idea of maximum sustainable generosity, because there tends to be so much outflow with the nurturer. It's also really important to make sure that you create the time to keep filling your tank.
For sure. For sure. Well, that was pretty incredible. You seem to know these inside out. I'm going to give you a few names here, and I want to caveat this by saying that I'm aware that it's almost impossible to guess what somebody's sparker type is from the outside, because a totally different thing could be happening internally, but you can't base this on their outside behavior. But I think it might be helpful for people just to illustrate some of the concepts. If I give you maybe a couple of names and then you would maybe say what their primary sparker type might be, is that okay?
I'm happy to, but like you just said, the huge caution there is often the behavior that we see externally with somebody is absolutely not a manifestation of their internal drives or impulses. They're performing something that they feel like they have to do in order to satisfy expectations. So the only thing that I could comment on is how somebody shows up in the world. But I would have no idea whether like that's basically an identity that they're wearing publicly or if it's the real them. So I could kind of public, I could comment on the public side of it, but I couldn't tell you whether that's actually what's happening on the inside.
Sure. Well, these are educated guesses, I suppose, sure. Or just, okay. So Andrew Huberman.
Ooh, he feels like a strong maven and scientist to me. You know, like he is somebody, for those who don't know him, he's one of the top podcasters. He's a professor and researcher at Stanford. And he goes so, so deep into the weeds of any particular topic. He becomes encyclopedic. And in order to become that encyclopedic from a knowledge standpoint, it's generally not driven by something external. There's an internal impulse that says like, there's something deeply exciting and engaging about just knowing everything I can possibly know about one particular topic. So it would seem from the outside looking in that there's a very strong maven element to him. And also scientist, he seems like the type of person, again, from the public presentation, who loves to figure things out, who loves to get at solutions to problems. So it would be to me from the outside presentation, it would appear that there would be, you know, strong maven and scientist energy there.
Now this is interesting because I've heard him speak of this before. He says like where he gets his real kicks in his work is the sharing. It's finding something really complex, like really understanding it, and then sharing with others in a way that they get it. So maybe there's a bit of sage in there too, you know?
Entirely. And that's something that I'd never heard him say, but like, if you add that into the mix, yeah, 100%, you know, he's also a professor. So, you know, that could be a big piece of it as well. You know, like he could also, and it's interesting. It's often hard to tell because sometimes a sage like primary will go deep into the knowledge side so that they have something truly unique and different and insightful to share. Sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes somebody will actually use a job like being a teacher as effectively a funding mechanism to justify spending vast amounts of time and resources deepening into a topic that absolutely fascinates them. And the real underlying drive is actually the maven there. So it's sometimes a little bit hard to tease out like which takes the lead there. And like I said, from the outside looking in, it would be impossible for me to really know. But like, you know, clearly there seem to be pieces of those present.
Sure. What about Oprah Winfrey?
Ooh, I have no idea. There are so many different aspects to Oprah and I feel like she has changed the way that she's shown up over, you know, she's been a public person for what, 40 years now, 50 years. And I would imagine in each season of that, that she has changed the way that she showed up publicly. Also because she's been such a public person and she has operated in domains where her ability to stay public, especially in the early part of life in the entertainment business, it's not just about you showing up as yourself. It's all also about, are you showing up in a way that checks the profit boxes, that meets the norms of the day? And those norms and those profit boxes and the business models around them have changed and evolved profoundly over the course of her career. And so I don't know if she's the type of person that really takes that into account and in how she shows up and what she creates and how she offers herself or not. Or whether from the very beginning, she just showed up and said, I am who I am, deal with it or not, and has really sort of like kept to that from the very early days. I think it's a lot harder to do that when you're younger in your career than when you're more established and older and the power equation changes. So it would be harder for me to really comment intelligently, even from the outside, because I think there's been just such profound and beautiful evolution in the way that she showed up over different seasons of her life and career.
That's fair. That's fair. Okay. So whenever people are taking the assessment, can you give them any guidance on what to do and things definitely not to do?
Yeah. And we say this right at the top of the assessment. One, don't answer the questions in the way that you hoped you would be as a human being. Answer them in the way that you actually know yourself to truly be. You know, we all tend to project. We all kind of want to say like, ooh, I'm this person who's super generous and I love taking care of other people. And I, like I'm just, I'm the one who's always there and like the one who's always giving care. But then there's this inner voice that says, actually, I'm not. Like, I wish I was that person, but I'm really not. You know, so there's a lot of I wish I was that person that we want to just kind of set off to the side. Like when you go into it, just say to yourself, I'm going to do this for me and only me. Nobody else needs to know how I'm answering these questions. Nobody else will ever know or see like what this, what my profile is like once I get it. I can keep it entirely to myself. If like I want to share it, I can. And go into it sort of like that way and really try and be as honest. If there's not an easy, obvious answer that sort of like just pops into your head to the 50 plus questions in the assessment, tune into your body. Oftentimes our body gives us visceral signals about what is resonant and what is not. And listen to that as well. The algorithm for the assessment is actually much more complex than people would assume or realize. We actually have certain tolerances that are built into it that kind of watch you as you're answering the questions. And if it determines that you're not discerning answers in a way that we feel like would allow us to assign values at the end of it, it will actually dynamically add questions to the end to try and nudge you to make more discerning choices, harder choices. So that's why I say it's 50 plus questions, because not everybody takes the same assessment. It actually adapts dynamically to the way that somebody is answering it. And I think that's also one of the reasons why a lot of people experience it as being so accurate, because it does that. And it kind of says like, think about this a little bit more, like what's really going on here. So if it picks up, that's happening, you'll get a couple of extra questions. The other thing is that, sometimes folks will come to it wanting a particular profile. and for the first couple of years, we actually didn't share all the different types until somebody already had taken it, because we didn't want somebody sort of like taking it and then trying to answer the questions in a way that gamed it. And like, well, they think, well, if I answer it this way, then I'll get this particular thing, then I'll be a maven or a maker. And that's what I want to be, because I want to call myself that. And then I want to tell other people this is what I am. So we invite people to really not do that, to really just get honest. We call that sparkotype shopping, by the way. and we will on occasion see somebody take the assessment, you know, like 2-3 times rapid fire. And it's pretty obviously what's happening there. You know, they didn't love the answer that they got. That doesn't mean it wasn't accurate. It means that like they would have preferred it be something else. So they'll start to try and take it again and game the questions just to get a different outcome. So, the broad invitation is just let go of judgment, let go of who you think you should or could or want to be, and answer in the context of who you know yourself to be at this moment in time.
For sure. For sure. Well, I was saying before we started recording that I normally hate personality tests, and I think I hate them because I hate being told who I am. I hate being put in the box, I suppose. But there was something different about this. Like, I got a lot from taking it, and I was like, oh, geez, I actually am. That really does sound like that really does fit me very well. So I think it's a great resource. And I think it's the book and the assessment are sort of like companions that like, they really help each other, you know? So I would definitely recommend people do this. Something... Getting off the topic of sparkotypes now, just a couple of sort of big picture questions to wrap up here. Is there anything that you now know very clearly that you might have wished you had have known at the start of your entrepreneurial journey and embodied back then?
Probably the one thing that actually comes up is the importance of self-awareness and the importance of understanding the role that your attention plays in the experience of everything that you do. I came to a meditation practice, a mindfulness practice, very much on my knees, not because I wanted to, but because I was dealing with some really big challenges and I thought maybe it would help. And that practice has since taken me from a very dark place to baseline, and then from baseline to really being able to be much more present and acknowledge the moment, the experience, the beauty and the grace, and be grateful for what I have. But also at the same time, it's helped me let go of the things that I can't control and identify what those things are. It's helped me let go. It's helped me notice the negative things that might exist just in my head, challenge them and let them go. And when you're making anything in the world, you're going to be subject to a lot of circumstances outside of your control and potentially a lot of chatter that happens in your head around the stories that you're telling about all of those different moments, and to just stress and complexity that can be pretty high stakes and sustained for a long period of time. So my mindfulness practice has been really profound in affecting not just my entrepreneurial journey, but my relationships, my life, my ability to be present and grateful no matter what comes my way. And that, as I mentioned, is a more recent addition to my life, really the last dozen years or so, because I've been wired as a maker and I've been an entrepreneur literally since I was a young kid. It would have eased a lot of suffering had I had that practice and those skills a lot earlier in life.
That's good advice. The next, or the final thing I want to ask you, how do you want the world to be different because you've lived?
I don't really think about that, to be honest with you. I think about, I'm oddly disconnected from the notion of legacy. I think more on a day-to-day basis, have I opened my eyes? Have I done good work? Have I shown up as myself? Have I been kind and present? And have I done something that nourishes me, like, at the same time? And I think more on a day-to-day basis, like, if I keep doing that, then the answer to the question you just asked, it's going to figure itself out. And I don't really care how it figures itself out. Like, the one, if I was going to say that I did care, it would be in a much more immediate way, which is, you know, like in the context of my child and my wife and my friends and my family, you know, like, because to me, that's where I have the opportunity for the greatest impact. That's where I can show up the most. I have the greatest amount of control over how anything that I do and any way that I am makes a difference. So that's more of where I focus my energy rather than sort of the more global question of, like, how the world might perceive anything that I put into it.
That's a great response. And I think it's a lot more kind of empowering. It brings the center to you and your daily actions. And yeah, I can see the power in that. So, Jonathan, I just want to say a huge thank you for sharing some of your insights and wisdom with us today. And I think the book and the assessment are both fantastic resources. And you just, it's like we spend one third of our lives working, and what you're essentially creating here is something that can help people do work every day that makes them come fully alive. You know, it's not going to happen instantly. And something you talk about as well is that don't blow everything up, you know, like, take your time and do it the right way. So I just think it's a fantastic resource, and I really recommend it. After this conversation, what would you recommend people to do or go online, anything to check out? I would definitely recommend the book, but I'll let you go from here.
Yeah, I mean, if you're curious about it, the assessment, as I mentioned, is freely available at sparkatype.com. So anyone can take it. You know, there's no barrier to actually being able to at least take that first step. And if you learn something, like, fantastic. If it feels like it resonates, great. If you're more curious just about the conversations we've been hosting at Good Life Project for a dozen years now, if you literally just type Good Life Project or my name, Jonathan Fields, into any search engine, you'll find all the stuff pretty readily. So, and I also just wanted to thank you, you know, like, for your presence today, for your kindness, for your listening. Your questions were just really wonderful and deeply insightful and open-mindedness, and for inviting me here to participate in the conversation.
Thank you, Jonathan. So we'll just end the recording there. Really good interview. Thank you very much. And
yeah, my pleasure.
I'll just be following, you know, your progress, and it's as I said, it's such important work, and it's something I'm super interested in myself. So I'll keep an eye on what you're up to, and hopefully at some point in the future we can reconnect.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, I'm super excited. As I mentioned, this year, actually, like, hopefully in the first quarter, we'll be rolling out our first sort of forward facing, just, you know, direct to individual, like, end to end program around incorporating all this stuff into the process of exploring career. So I'm excited to get that out into the world. It's kind of been behind the scenes for a number of years now, and hopefully it helps people.
What's your biggest struggle right now? Like, your biggest challenge, would you say?
Bandwidth. Apparently, like, I've learned that there's one of me.
Right. Okay.
And I'm not quite on the bandwagon to experiment with cloning quite yet. So I have an amazing team, but yeah, we have so many things we want to do. So it's just limitations and resources.
That's fair. Before the interview, I was reading your article. It was on your blog about avoiding the middle.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, like I don't want to go there. You know, like, what do you call it?
Yeah, I call it the unfortunate middle. I think more recently, I just kind of call it the messy middle, but it's the place that most entrepreneurs land and stay, never really realizing that it was never intended to be a place that you land. You know, it's supposed to be a stage that you move through, and, you know, so you can get to that, like, that next stage, you know, complex grace, basically, where you have all the benefits of scale, but, like, you personally get to live with much more simplicity. And most entrepreneurs never make it there. And they just stay in that space, and it is a grind, you know, and it's kind of like, you have to go through it if you want to get to the next one. But not everybody actually wants to get to the next one. It's actually like, it's for most people, it's probably pretty cool to stay like in that simple grace stage as well.
For sure. For sure. Right. I'll let you go. Thanks a million. Have a great hike. And
sounds good.
We'll talk
Thanks.
Soon. A bit.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. And I hope you enjoyed the show. If you'd like to hear the full version, you can do so with the Weekend University Premium Membership. This gets you access to our master library of over 5 years of psychology conferences, including over 230 talks and interviews with the world's leading psychologists, professors, and authors, unlimited CPD certification, transcripts, quizzes, premium passes for our annual conference, online courses with Richard Schwartz and Deb Dana, and more. The cost is £97 for 1 year, which breaks down at around 27p per day. The best bit is you can try it out for 30 days completely risk-free, as all orders come with a 100% money-back guarantee. If you're interested, please go to twumembers.com for more information.